Hi, I'm Joe Quirk. I talk to seasteaders and their supporters. What if the Maldives Islands, which is scheduled to be the first nation to sink below sea level, became the cutting-edge innovation hub for floating cities? What if you could float the rich infrastructure of Holland straight to the slums of Bangladesh? What if the future of floating cities, getting ever cheaper and more nuanced, is in 3D printed technology? I spoke to Koen Uthuis, a Dutch architect who founded Water Studio and co-founded Dutch Docklands, and he's moving forward on all these visions and more. In 2007, Koen was named one of Time Magazine's most influential people of that year. He co-authored a book called Float, which discusses construction on the water, and his TEDx talk about floating cities makes it all seem like common sense. Koen Uthuis and the Seasteading Institute have agreed to partner to bring about this future, and there's places where we agree, and there's a few places where we disagree. So I had this conversation with Koen just after Koen spoke with Chris Mulia, our managing director at the Seasteading Institute, who is working on a business model for 3D printed seasteads, which Koen says makes sense. Chris and I had just talked to Bob Ballard, who discovered the Titanic. He's a rock star oceanographer. And Bob has engineering plans for affordable seasteads that would remain stable on the high seas. So it was an exciting 3 days where these large figures in the floating city movement all began to forge these overlaps in their visions. And I want to let you listen in on this wide-ranging conversation with Koen Uthuis of Water Studio. And I hope you find it as intriguing as I did. Koen.
Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm very happy to be talking to you. This is Joe Quirk.
Super.
And I'm very excited to try to pronounce your name. Koen Uthuis?
Koen is okay. It's Uthuis.
I'll just stick with Koen, yeah. I'm very excited to pronounce your name terribly because it shows how floating cities are a global phenomenon.
It is.
And
it is.
And thank you for speaking English. I don't know Dutch, but I know Holland is where all the coolest floating construction is happening.
Well, have you been there?
I've never been there, though my colleague Randolph Henkin has been there.
Okay.
And I'm a big fan of everything that's happening in Holland.
It's exciting, yeah. But I also have to say that the Dutch are quite innovative, but on the other hand, they're also a bit afraid of implementing everything in their own country. What we see now is that the most exciting things we come up with are we not doing right here. Because I think a country that has been for centuries fighting the water has a bit difficulties of changing into something that is much more living with water. Although we preach this, it's not that you can see and find floating houses everywhere. It's for myself, I live on land. I would love to live on the water. But it is difficult to get a good spot, a big spot, and having regulations over there that are in balance with my needs. I think the Dutch are much looking back in history. And if I tell them what my floating house or floating estate would look like, it doesn't fit the regulations. So for me, it's interesting to work in other countries, seeing, for instance, the Maldives, for instance, China or even Thailand, where regulations are now different and where also there are more possibilities of implementing larger floating structures.
And the Maldives will be the first nation to disappear due to rising sea levels.
Yes, well, there are a bit more of those. What I find quite interesting is that one of your statements where you said we have to save the Maldives as a country. But if you really look at what you can find right now, it's 700 kilometers of country, 1,200 something small land mass islands. But in reality, it's already 90-95% of the Maldives is underneath the water. If you fly over it, you see all these beautiful lagoon structures. It's all coral just below the sea level. So it's already a sunken country.
Yeah.
And if you see how the amount of people living on in this huge area, it's like 300,000 people, of which 110,000 are living in Male, which is the main capital. It's take just an average city in the States, and it'll probably be much larger than that. So it's also the question: if we're going to save the Maldives, what are we going to save? Are we going to save the culture? Are we going to save the people from drowning? Are we going to save the coral, which is there, and the nature? Are we going to save tourism, which is a huge resource of income? So it's quite complicated what we can do, what we should do, and why we should do it. And if we're going to spend like millions and millions of dollars and billions of dollars in saving such a grand country, we should also see if it's necessary to put our money in that country, or that we maybe have to treat the Maldives as a fantastic place where we can experiment with these kind of new exciting floating structures and see how we can bring that technology in the future also to the more dense cities like New York, London, Tokyo, Shanghai, where they also have to work with the rising sea levels.
Yeah, man, imagine if the nation threatened by rising sea levels became the innovation hub for floating cities.
That would be fantastic.
An entrepreneur in the Maldives has reached out to the Seasteading Institute, and I'm talking with him. And you, with your co-founder, Paul van de Kamp's Dutch Docklands, you guys co-founded, you propose and design some extraordinary projects for the Maldives. Can you tell me about some of your favorites?
Yeah, well, there are two kind of projects. We have the projects which we are developing now. It's the five lagoons, which are five lagoons in the North Malay Atoll. So it's like in a distance of 25 kilometers from the main capital, where we, together with the government, start joint venture to see how we can develop tourism in those lagoons. The ocean flowers, the one we started. That one is exciting because it's 185 floating villas, and those are in shaped in a flower. So you have a big floating boulevard. It has the shape of flower. It is the national flower of the Maldives. And
that's what it is. The national flower of the Maldives.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And because the depth of the water lagoon is only 15 meters over there. So then we have some, I think, like five main piles, which with the complete project is being pointed down on the ground. And so it can move vertically, but can't move horizontal. And then there's a few hotel resources, hotel facilities also on the beach. There's a small natural beach over there.
And I've been following your work for a few years now, and you're obviously very driven to build floating cities. And why do you care about this so much? Like, when did you realize you had to devote yourself to building floating structures?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the question is, am I devoted to floating cities? Or because when I started, I really was. I think the same as you, I was really focused on see what the next floating city on the ocean could be. But through time, through the last 14 years is what we do this, is I've stepped a bit away from that and much more focusing on floating structures within existing cities. Mm-hmm. So there's also the talk I had with your colleague 2 weeks ago, where we say it was a fantastic, we had a fantastic hour. Because we both had the idea that the things we are doing and the things that I'm doing and Seasteading is doing is, in the end, we have the same goal, but we go toward the route toward that goal is different, because I'm much more focusing on existing cities to see how we can solve problems of that cities, because I think that cities in themselves are not perfect, that they are just concepts, and that we have to keep on putting innovation in the evolution of cities to make them now perfect in balance with our needs, and that cities today are too much static, and that our communities are very much dynamic. So that always when we want to change something, or something changes because of ecology, of money, of politics, that our city can't compete with that, and that's too slow. So it's, I think it's interesting, and that's my goal, to see how we can use water to make our cities better, with a shorter response time, and easier to adapt to new and unknown changes and challenges. So, and what I said to Chris also is that what my view of, about seasteading is, and that is not even probably, and he explained it, it's not even the real goal, but what media tells about seasteading is that it's about starting a community in the middle of the ocean, having their own rules, having their own authority and all. And for me, that is a fantastic future image, but it's also one where you can't imagine that you can help millions and billions who are in need in the real world on land today. So for me, what do the last few years, and also with all the slums, and see how we can upgrade slums with floating structure is what I think that can have a positive effect.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that the move to the seas will start with the expansion of coastal states and coastal slums. And I love your vision of city apps, where you're transforming these shipping containers into things that can be delivered to the wet slums. Can you tell me a little about that? Is that still underway?
Well, as you probably know, there are 1 billion people living in slums today, and I think like 40 to 60% of those slums are next to the water. It can be like rivers, floodplains, canals, seas, and what you see is that it's very difficult to upgrade slums, because slums in themselves are illegal. They are there. That's why they're also why they're called slums. Otherwise, they're just deprived city areas. And for governments to do something, or municipalities to do something in those slums, it's almost impossible. Because if you do something, then you would acknowledge their or change their status from illegal to legal. For developers who want to do something in slums, it's also impossible. Because if you want to build a school, or you want to build sanitation, it can be that your investment can be gone in 2 or 3 years, because there can be a eviction or something else. So that means that people are not willing to spend money, and people who live in slums themselves, even people who want to start a business in slums, there is no space in slums, and they're in wet slums next to the water. They are also threatened by the water. So if you can find a way to bring those three problems, space, unsafety, illegal spaces, and the fact that you can't invest in it, if you want to solve that, you have to come up with floating structures that are also almost like products, which you can move from one slum to another slum. You should go from project to product. Well, that's what we do with city apps. We put them in containers, the functions, and that's the only reason is that it's quite easy to move them from one location to another location. But in the container itself, you can put almost any function you would like. The one we just built is a floating school, which is, if you see inside those that container, it's very high-tech. It feels a bit like a space lab.
Yeah, it's very futuristic.
The best materials. And I also think that this school could easily last for like 10, 12 years. You can just change the iPads or the tablets within time, but the structure itself can last for a longer time than only 2 years, which or 3 years, which is the average of any functions being placed in slums today. So by that, you can have investors in Europe who want to put some money in it, like $32,000, and that's what the school costs. And entrepreneurs within the slum who want to lease these kind of functions. So we go to a lease structure where you don't have to pay for the complete element, but you can just lease it and make money rent from that. And then once there is an eviction, you can just take the school back and bring it to another slum, or even when it's not needed anymore, you can just take it away. You can compare that with the auto industry, where 20, 30 years ago, it was difficult to own your car. You have to pay a lot of money. And today, everybody has many people in Holland even have leased cars. So you have seen that market has exploded too. And I think the only way to really make an impact in those slums is to make sure that people can make money from those slums, and by that slowly upgrade it from a what we call a two-star slum to a three-star slum, and upwards to a five-star slum.
That's beautiful.
I see slums nothing else than a almost like a camping site. We have campings here in Holland, and the ones which are really bad, where you only have a little bit of cold water, and you have the ones which you call glamping, and where you have this fantastic. You have your own bathroom in your tent, and then, so you see that through the years, these kind of camping sites have suddenly changed into almost normal neighborhoods, and that's also how we should go with slums worldwide. You can't just put money in it and change the view of them. No, you have the problem is so big that you have so large that the only thing you can do is to upgrade it, and do that by using the water.
I love that this philanthropy is going to be driven by profit, and I'm struck that whether we're talking about Bangladesh or Holland, there's always this problem with regulations that are not upgrading to the new needs. You know, the slums are illegal, and yet there's millions of people who live there. Floating urbanization is needed in Holland, and yet it's difficult to do. And I think seasteaders think too far ahead because we're eager to get these governance startups on the water. And what I appreciate about Chris Mulia, our Mariner colleague who you talk to, is that he's thinking about how do you get affordable technologies for high seas seasteading. And he's working on a business model for 3D printed seasteads. Does his vision coincide with your vision? I'd love to hear about your conversation.
Yeah, because it's for him, it's about technology, and it doesn't matter if you want to use it in the middle of the open sea or you just want to use it within your city. And I think that his technology is just bridging the ideas of seasteading and my ideas, because I think we should first start using them in cities. And I completely appreciate his ideas where he tries to be as cheap as possible, because I think that's the only way to do it. And if there's a technology where we can produce large-scale floating structures which are ready to develop houses, apartments, and complete the roads and gardens on top of it, and then you have your first step towards a floating neighborhood, floating town, floating city, floating country. So I think these kind of people who start to develop these technologies are essential. I'm always open for new technology, but we still use the technology that is being used in Holland for the last almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. We have floating houses here in Holland, which are a bit smaller than the ones we do today, but floating houses in Amsterdam, which are now exactly 100 years old, made of concrete, which the people have built the second or the third house on top of it. The foundation is still perfectly active. So today it's very difficult to find another material that is as strong and as long-lasting as the concrete. But if you can go to something that is cheap, faster made, to be built, and in bigger dimensions, that would be fantastic, because it would really open a lot. And the fact that you go to 3D printing means also that you don't have to go to factories and mm-hmm. bring it all over the world, but you can almost print it at the location where you need it. And I think that's one of the strongest steps. And if you then really think futuristic, and we can also use garbage and leftover plastic to build these kind of foundations, then you would really make a difference. And that's what we do in our slums is also, we do the foundations. It's very, very simple, but the foundations that we make is made of the PET bottles. We make very simple floating foundations of 15,000 PET bottles, they should bring together and give a little bit of strength to the superstructure around it, and then we place a container on top of it.
Yeah,
but it's not in the, you can't compare it to his fantastic ideas of the 3D printing, but it's both based on using garbage or leftover plastic to create something new.
Yeah, and I think your vision foresees Chris Mulia's vision, because that whole idea that the slum children can collect plastic bottles, you send a factory, a small little container ship there that they can put the plastic in, and then that you make a platform that then you can build your city, you can put your containers on. That foresees what Chris is saying. And what I love about the 3D printing vision is the potential for construction materials to ride a wave of exponential change. So, you know, as 3D construction makes city building an information technology where you can design your platform on a computer and then email it to your floating city, which will print the module, you'll see materials getting cheaper and cheaper and designs getting subtler and more nuanced, and you'll engage this exponential trend toward ever cheaper designs for floating cities. So this requires...
Yeah, and what it also does, is, and that is for me really interesting, is that you also can make the step from not only designing the floating island and everything you see above the water, but it's much easier to also start designing everything that's underneath the water. But because we're focused on for the last year, we also do that together with Chomichov Patel, is to see how we can design the underside of these islands, the underside of the floating foundation, to see a potential for not only being scarless, not having an effect, but also we have a positive effect on habitats in the water. So by having the possibility to print any shape, any kind of small spaces where and fishes and the coral can start to build underneath those islands, and that's fantastic. And that we can't do without 3D printing, because if you do it in concrete, the material is very strong, but it is very difficult to make these very subtle and beautiful small structures.
Yeah, and you can see that the future of cities that are not just sustainable but potentially environmentally restorative are these 3D printed floating cities.
Yeah.
I see the confluence of a lot of different technologies. We have a seasteader among us named Michael Elliott, who I interviewed, and he's developing a geopolymer concrete that he says is carbon negative. And he's on the water right now experimenting with this, or at least he's, you know, curing different kinds of carbon negative stuff. You have the French magazine, Terra Eco, it chose you as one of the 100 people who will change the world. And you have this great tagline to your emails, which is, green is good, blue is better. And what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that people are really focusing on green sustainability, which is fantastic and great. But sometimes we also make some mistakes in that. Let me start with that first. If you see the guys who are into the cradle-to-cradle ideologies, I don't believe in that. Completely, I think it's almost a kind it's not true, because you can't have all the world, everybody just trying to build something and bring it back to its elements and restart again. I think it's much more better to just focus on durability. So if you build something, you should also use it for the complete technical lifespan. Because if you do it the other way around, you build something that could last for 100 to 150 years, and after 20 years you start demolish it and bring it back to elements and then restart to build something else, then it's loss of energy. So I rather build something of concrete, which is takes a little bit more energy and is difficult to reuse again, but I can use it for 150 years, and I can also use it on different locations, and that's where the water comes in. That's also where I think blue is better, because blue gives you the water gives you the possibility to add an extra dimension of freedom into your projects, and by that you can use your products not only on one location but on several locations, and it's easier to adapt and to add stuff to it. And what I mean with my tagline, green is good, blue is better, I think we still have, we as you as Seasteaders, we as Dutch entrepreneurs focusing on water, see how water can be an answer to many problems in our cities. And it's not only about flooding, but it's also about economics of a city, and had grown in more in density. We have this fantastic professor in Toronto, which is Florida, who has all these ideas that the ideal city should be almost 10 times more dense than the cities we see today around us. Mm-hmm. But the only way to create more density is what, as we see it today, is to grow into height and to make more higher buildings and bring those high buildings together. But what I see, and what probably you see too, is that there's this huge opportunity of these big cities which are next to the water, in which almost 50% of the territory is on water, and where we can just grow over the water, and where we can create another kind of density, which is will bring a more compact city. And that compact cities will not only be compact and dense, but also will be much more flexible, because within that city you can just add and change and reconfigurate what you want. The energy you can find on the water. There's this huge buffer of cool water and warm water, which is an energy source which you still don't use enough. But I think it's fantastic to see how our cities can use the energy from the water, which is also much more sustainable than you can do on land. Our ideas for the floating solar fields, where you see that we have now, people are thinking about floating solar fields that are being placed on islands, but we go one step further. I just see them as fantastic, almost fish-eye-shaped glass, 3-meter diameter solar panels that are floating in the water, and not one, but thousands of them, just almost together, which you can just pass through them with your boat, and they just they hubble a little bit with the water. And the thing about solar panels is that in Celsius they are almost 70 degrees because of the sun, which is absorbing energy. But the best temperature for a solar cell is around 27 degrees Celsius. You work with Fahrenheit, with Celsius. So that means that if you have a normal water temperature, like in Dubai, in Maldives, is like 25 degrees. So if you have them really on the water, and the water is just overtopping constantly your floating cell, and it will be brought back to a temperature in which the energy which come out of that solar cell is that much better. So in general, I think with my tagline, I want to say is that I think we only have discovered like 10% of the possibilities that water could attribute to the our better cities, and that there is a huge world to discover for engineers and architects and urban planners for how we can use our water in our cities better to create better cities.
It's really extraordinary, because like your designs for Dubai show how you can use the water to, you know, they struggle with heat, and how you can cool the floating mosques and the floating structures you've designed. It just seems like people who are pushing floating cities like yourself, they just win on every argument. It's like, it seems like everything is going to be better. Like we city folk on land don't even appreciate that demolishing places and building something better is hugely wasteful. And if you can make something durable, you can shift it around and move it on the water. And you're like, as you say, it'll be like a floating shuffleboard puzzle. Yep. The Saigon Floating Hotel was made back in the 80s, and it's moved among countries ever since. And it's very exciting. And if you hear noise in the background of my house, that's workmen replacing my foundation built in 1885 in my traditional land-based house. So I forgot this was going to happen, so I'm sorry. But how do foundations get built on water? You have a very interesting vision for that.
Yeah, well, just before we go down, I just want to say something else because that just pops into my mind. Eh? Now we're talking about these floating structures and how they can be much more flexible and how they can be durable by using them in different kind of locations. But it also brings a kind of eagerness, a kind of democracy to the complete world, because it's also more fair. I've talked somewhere in some articles about the Olympics. Mm-hmm. If you see about the Olympics, that it's so hard to get the Olympics to your city because you have to pay as a city so much money. That means that it's mostly the rich countries who can afford having a event like that. You don't see it in many Asian countries. You don't see it in many African countries. But I think that water gives us the possibility to come to other kind of models where the most rich countries in the world, like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Norway, will start to build these kind of floating facilities, like floating hotels, floating harbors, floating stadiums, and start to lease them out to cities that are less fortunate and who have less money. So that means that even when you are not as rich as London or Rio or Beijing, you still can try to compete to get the Olympics to you, because you can just lease the essential structures on water and use them only for half year or a year and then send them back to another country. So thinking about that, you will see that worldwide we get a complete different kind of industries by using the water. And it's not longer about fixed locations, but it is about that countries like Qatar, which can't spend all the money in their own country, can now start spending money worldwide in global mobile assets, as we call them.
And when you think about, like, 90% of what we consume is brought to us on container ships, and then you have your vision for how the rich infrastructure of Holland can be brought to Bangladesh by floating it there. And if it becomes a problem, you can pull out and move it somewhere else. I mean, the potential for kind of global wealth to be unleashed, you can imagine Qatar pays for a floating stadium, and that costs a lot of money, but then they don't need to use it again after they have, say, the Olympics there, and then they can lease it out more cheaply to the next to the next country. That's amazing. Yes. I mean, people think seasteaders think big, and you think very big.
You're just about your question about how to produce. Because I interrupted you in your question. You asked me how you think. Sorry.
So we have engineering challenges ahead of us, and I think you've demonstrated the solution in some of the floating houses you've made, which is basically the deeper the hull, the lower the center of gravity, and the more stable it is in waves. Yeah. And I just had a great conversation with Robert Ballard. He's the ocean explorer who discovered the Titanic. And he proposes the flip structure for seasteads. Have you seen the flip?
No.
It's a long cylinder, like a pillar in the water, and it's so heavy at the bottom. It's described as being as stable as a fence post in 70-foot waves. And Ballard says you could take four flips, put a platform across it, and it'll be as stable as a table.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be like there's something very awkward. I live in earthquake country. I have a foundation built of brick back in 1885, and now I have to shore my house up and replace it. It's very expensive. I was just today watching a video about some of the houses you've sold in Holland, where people live. There's one floor above the water and then another floor below the water, and it's very stable.
It's true that of course, the lower you're into the water, the more stable you are. But also the bigger structure gets, the more stable they get. But it is, so what we see today is that we're not only, what we say to municipalities, and also in Holland we have some little earthquakes here, is that if your city is threatened by the water, by floods, and if your city is threatened by hurricanes or even by earthquakes, the safest place to be is on the water. Mm-hmm. Because by earthquake, you have not a direct contact with the soil, so it's that safe. With floods, you go up and down, and even by hurricanes, we did this measurements and this calculations for Miami. You see that once the wind starts to suck on all these buildings and try to break it, you see that the floating structures like boats, they can just go up and down a bit. They will act like a spring. They will absorb a lot of the energy. So it's if you know all that and you have all this technology, then it's almost stupid to still build cities that are in those areas that are on land, ready for the floods, and have to struggle with all these strong winds, and have to struggle with all the earthquakes. Los Angeles, why don't we build much more there on the water? Same San Francisco. It's almost like people don't see the solution. Well, in the same time, it's so close to them. So I think it's interesting to see if we can slowly start what I call changing the DNA of the buildings that are in these kind of threatened cities. And if you see in Holland, the DNA of buildings have been changed through the years, and not even that they now are floating buildings, but the fact that we have today we have to build our buildings much more green as we did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I could just use single glass windows. We didn't have to use any insulation. The energy consumption of the buildings could be quite high. Today, they almost have to be energy neutral, and that's been pushed there by regulations. By law, we have to do that. So I also think that we should slowly start changing the DNA of buildings like in Miami, where we can say that, okay, today, the buildings we make in 2015 should cope with a flood of, for instance, 5 inches, and in 2017 it should be like 10 inches, and every building that's been built in that year should be much more resilient to any floods than the ones that have been built 2 years before that. So slowly you will grow into buildings that could cope with for instance 30 inches of water. And then slowly you see on one point that there will be a point where it doesn't make sense to make land-based houses, but where you grow into floating houses because they can cope with even more inches of water that you can expect. So by that you have a slow but steady grow because of the regulations into neighborhoods and towns and cities that are ready for any floods and any severe circumstances.
I imagine a future where people who live on the water will be talking to people who live on land and say, my God, how do you cope with floods and hurricanes and earthquakes? It's so much more safe on the water. I mean, we have a tsunami, we don't even notice it. Like, the tsunami doesn't become dangerous until it approaches land and starts to roll. Tsunami, you're safe from tsunamis on the sea. And what you're describing are stepping stones to the high seas, I think.
Yeah.
And so we have some engineering challenges ahead of us. And what's the next engineering challenge you think needs to be solved?
Well, I think before we go to that, it's more the mentality, the mindset we have to do. We don't have to see that as a threat, as something that is difficult and it costs money. But we have to see it as a positive challenge, because there will come out so much innovation, so much technology which we can sell to other countries, and so it's also a start of a complete new industry. It's the same when the Americans said we go to the moon. If you see how much of industry has come out of this one goal to do that, that's incredible. So this is how we treat also this problem. We have to say, okay, we want to make resilient cities. We want to cope with earthquakes, with floods, with tsunamis, everything. And how should this technology should look like? And if we start doing that, and we put billions in it, the same as we have been putting in going out to space, we can make complete new industries which will make better cities, and on the other hand will make millions and millions and even billions for these countries who are there to open up for innovations and also make regulations where we can do that. So it's not really about technology. It's everything, facilities and finance and regulation around that allows us to implement new technologies and new ideas. Because if I want to build now a floating house in the United States, and then it's for many people, it's not sure: is it the house? Is it a boat? Is it real estate? Is it allowed that it goes up for a few centimeters? Now, all these most basic things are not being fixed yet. So that's the first challenge. And then, and technically, I think there. Now it's we have to make sure that everything we built on water should have the same look, feel, and maintenance and lifespan as the things we do on land. Because if we really want to push complete generations, a complete population of people into the water, then it should also for them be accepted that it is the same as on land. And today people still think about living on water as something that is not stable, very expensive, very difficult to get energy there. So that all these things have to move out. And the thing you mentioned about those guys who is coming up with technologies that are much more deep, much more stronger and much more stable. Yeah, that's the way to go. And we can learn so much about all this offshore industries. There's a lot of negative talks about the oil industry as being bringing pollution, but there's still also those guys have the most fantastic technologies. If they can have these oil rigs in the middle of the ocean near Mexico, and where 300 to 500 people are working on the situation and these kind of structures, yeah, if you can do that, and then a floating apartment in the lake in Miami is of course really really easy compared to that. Mm-hmm. So. I'm doing this project, which is called the Sea Tree, which is one of the projects that I really love. We worked on that for now already for 2.5 years, and we're still raising the funds to build it. But we still every half year it's been updated, and the project's getting cheaper and better. But it's just based on the technology of Shell, where they the oil company and how they make their floating oil structures. And we went to that company and we said, guys, you're putting that much money in getting a better image, a better imago to the outside world, and you're putting your money in Formula One and auto sports as an advertisement. But we think you can also do a green advertisement. You can also build this kind of sea trees, which have a positive effect on ecology in a city. It's nothing else than a very dense park, and they've been cut out in pieces and put like a tower on top of each other. And it looks fantastic. People love it. And put your technology and your money in that, because it's only a little bit of money, but the effect you will create and what people think about your oil industry as not only being polluted but also having a positive effect on ecology is I think the most brilliant step they can make. But for them it's very difficult to change their thoughts and mindsets, where they're usually putting money in complete other kind of industries and not in this creating green.
Yeah, and I've talked to a guy who works for a nonprofit involved with keeping oil platforms from being decommissioned, because the oil platforms become like your sea tree, which is at various levels underground. They're home to all sorts of wildlife, and then if they're not used, birds nest in them. So they actually become a place that produces wildlife. And if you could combine your vision of the sea tree with this multi-level ecosystem, with the oil platform technology, with the cruise ship comfort, you could have your permanent floating city out there. So according to my research, like the Maldives seems pretty safe from typhoons and hurricanes, but it was hit fairly hard by a tsunami.
Yep, 2004. Yeah,
2004. Does this make floating structures there more of a challenge?
Well, I think they are like 4 degrees above the equator, so that's mm-hmm. also why they don't have these kind of hurricanes over there. And the tsunami who hit the islands, I think it was like a meter half high, so it was not even that high, because waves are really difficult to build up because there's no land mass over there. I think the problem with a tsunami is not the high the fluctuation of the water, but is the speed of the fluctuation, and so you have to make sure that all your technical solutions are able to cope with this sudden raise and the rise in water levels. Another project we are now developing and preparing for the Maldives are floating islands, which are floating mm-hmm. islands that are not that big, or that the islands are like the biggest we know designed is like 5,000 square meter, so that will be 50,000 square feet. So it's an average, it's half of a football field, a soccer field, something like that. And those ones are being anchored down with cables. And the beauty about those cables is that there is some flexibility, and these can easily cope with meter half, 2 meters of water coming in with a speed of like 50 kilometers per hour. So the speed where a tsunami will come with. So that's much easier than, for instance, the project like the Ocean Flower, which are 185 houses, and we also need some gliding telescopic piles there to keep it keep them anchored down. So it's having one single floating island with enough space around it is easier than high density floating houses next to each other. So, but for both, you can handle it. I think every problem can be handled in the technology. Only the price you have to pay to handle it is different. And then it seems that those floating islands are much easier and much more affordable for the bigger audience than this high end difficult floating structures as we have them also here in Holland.
It seems like you have all this in your vision. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Green Star, and one of the really enchanting ones is the Kristall in Norway. Mm-hmm. It's like a 5-star floating hotel built in the shape of a snowflake. Yeah. Yeah, it's gorgeous. But then, so that looks like, you know, futuristic, beautiful, near future stuff for the developed world. But the City Apps vision, where you bring these, it seems like it would work, you know, floating structures and put them at the edge of these coasts where you think about, like, if you look at the map of world population, it's like humanity is just racing toward the sea. They're racing to be right next to the oceans because that's the global superhighway of goods, and it's where everybody wants to be. And you can see in a large vision that even those poorest countries in the world are going to need to step off the edge and join the new cities of the floating urbanization of the future. And it's such a big vision that it's difficult to start for the first it's difficult to start with the right first message that's going to appeal to a particular person. And I think we've underestimated the humanitarian potential of floating cities. In our messaging.
Well, it starts, I think, and that's the most difficult thing, is that we are not trained, not we as architects, not as urban planners, but also all my friends, everything, even everybody in Holland. We are not trained to see our cities as something that is in the move, and that is something that is not perfect. I think we have politicians and created a world where we always try to keep everything almost the same as it is today, because all our regulations are
just made to protect the thing that we have today. And I think if you look back 100 years in time, like the 1800s, 1900s, it was so much different. People, the regulations were so much easier. So it was easier to implement new technologies and new ideas. And what we should do, and we should train our architects and our urban planners, the people which we call the climate change generation, is that they still have a chance to really change the cities as they are today, and that they understand that this is just a concept that we have created with ourselves and that we call our city, but that the phenomenon of a city is still ready to mold into something else. And by that we should use an extra dimension, and that dimension is water. Because water will, in the end, have a huge effect on how cities will evolve in the next 50 to 100 years.
And it's so hard to persuade people, and so much easier to demonstrate something better. We do have this problem with people's perceptions need to fundamentally change to think about civilization on the water. And, you know, you mentioned the regulations, and much of what drives seasteaders is the perception that these, in the U.S., regulations written in the 20th century are preventing the innovations people like you bring for the 21st century, and which is why people are so interested in creating these political startups on the sea. But as you and Chris Mulia say, it's too hard to make that jump affordable. You have to start with the technologies to do so.
What we should do with it, and that's this, because that it reminds me about when I think was it Bill Clinton when he won the election, said that his famous word is about the economy stupid. Was it him who said that?
I know he said a lot.
Yeah, no, but it's also fun because of course without. But it's the same with this. If we or I see standing else wants to change something, it's about money. If you can show countries, municipalities, developers, even people who buy just a normal house, consumers, that living on water is cheaper, better, more long lasting, but in the end it will be giving them more financial potential. Yeah, then they will go for that, because in the end it's economy who drives new technologies. So what we should do is we should show examples where people could benefit from floating developments and have some not only examples on paper but also real practiced best practice solutions where you can see in the end that people can make money from water. And if you see what happened in cities here in Holland in the last 50 years, where agriculture has been transformed and rezoned in just building ground for cities, well, the same we should do with water. If we can buy water cheap and change it into more expensive building ground to build upon floating, then you will see that developers and even municipalities are ready for that. I've been to Hong Kong just now a few months ago, mm-hmm. and you see that the power of Hong Kong is in the hands of a small group of developers who have the land rights for the last pieces and ends of the water. But if you see the water has been owned by the municipality and by the government. So if they understand that if they start building and selling plots off the water, then they see that they can regain the power of the city. So the message that seasteading and we should bring to municipalities is that if you start allowing to build on water, you are the ones that have the water rights, because you have to you own the water. So by that you can reconfigure and redirect how a city will grow in the next 50 years. So it's for the politicians to regain their power in the cities.
And how would the Seasteading Institute help your vision?
Um,
Do you imagine
well,
a way we could work together?
I think, yes, I think so. And I think what Chris is doing is bridging that. This for me also, I was very, very enthusiastic about it. But I think where we can find each other is that I'm really impressed by what you all did in the last, I think it's almost 10 years in this business and building up, not and because we build up a name as an architect, but you build a name as an institute. And I think what I would do, and you already mentioned it, we have to bring, we have to play with media, and we have to play with messages, and we have to not only play with messages, but also we have to mean it. And people can feel if you really are behind the vision, or that's only a vision because you want to have some media. And I think there is a strong thing, because I think in the end, you will succeed. You will build a first floating city or floating neighborhood. But I think the first floating neighborhood should look a bit less futuristic as the images that you've been now bringing into the media for the last two or three years. And what also should be is that there should be a message, but it's not only what really contributes to the bigger problems that we see worldwide in our cities. And what I want to do is I want to be part of it. And I will. I think what I can learn from you is also how you raise money, because what we do with the Chocolates and also with Water Studio is it's quite small. If you see what the of course there's still some there's millions spent in the projects like the Maldives and Dubai, but creating a complete city on the water, as you post for places worldwide, it's not longer about millions, but it's almost about billions which you have to spend. And I think now that kind of money is not what we are thinking about.
Yeah. Well, so far we're a nonprofit institute who seeks to create for-profit companies building the technology of seasteads, and the fact we are supported by probably more than 1,000 donors over our whole existence, and it's coming mostly from people who love the idea of startup cities. They love the idea. They're sort of pioneers. They're sort of on the edge. It's not a mainstream community that supports us. It's a community that the type of people that left Europe to go to the United States. The next generation of that are the people going to seasteading. And it's always been my ambition to make our effort a mainstream topic of conversation. And so I'm an author, and next year a book about seasteading is going to come out, and I'm hoping it's going to change the conversation. And I get to put some images in there of what cities could look like. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Water Studio is interested in contributing an image of what a city could look like. The problem is I need it in November. But I'd like to include you in the book and bring this more humanitarian, environmental, improved in every way future of cities, this new perspective.
Yeah. No, that's a good idea. I think we can do some images of the city apps. There's an image, but I'm not quite sure if that would be a help to you. We designed some stuff for New York, for National Geographic. I think it's already 5 years ago, where they asked me how New York would look like if there was like 50 meters of water on that location, which is a possibility. And then what we said, we were designing complete dike around Manhattan and change it into a polder. And the idea behind what that was that if you really look at cities like London, New York, Amsterdam, it's only a small part of the city which really keeps the soul of the city. Amsterdam is nothing without the canals, and London is nothing without the central heart of London, and New York is nothing without Manhattan. So, and you see that all the neighborhoods around those city centers are just something that we call consumption urbanism, things that come and that will go with the lifespan of 50 or 80 years, or almost those buildings will all be demolished and changed for new ones. So if you consider that we have 50 meters of water in another 100, 150 years, that means that those neighborhoods around the center of the cities will have like two or three eclipses of loops regeneration. So those cities parts can slowly grow into floating, and then the center of the cities you have to protect. And so that means that the center of Amsterdam we have to protect with dikes and levees, and also the Manhattan we can just build dikes around and change into a polder. So common with here in Holland. And of course, then you have to pump the water out that comes in, but that's not from then they do today. Because if you see all the tubes and the metro system underneath Manhattan, if you stop pumping water out there, then also without a day or two, half of the system will be flooded by groundwater that comes into those tubes. But coming back to your question, so we have some images for that, but that is not, there's not really seasteading. It's much more about single cities into the water. But we designed some images which are a bit at the shovel puzzle city. Yes, you've seen that, right? The one that we can move like puzzle pieces.
I think that for me is
those images are for me the closest to what I think should be a floating city. And it's just almost a normal city, only the roads have been changed by water, and but that you get all this city pieces and puzzle pieces which you can reconfigure to any other shape. And it's the difficulty is not about the picture of that city, but it's the performance of that picture. And I think that a good new city won't grow from the inside to the outside, but I think the next city will grow from the inside itself by making space in the inside. So it will just move and push from the heart of the city other pieces away, and it will regenerate from the inside. So that's different than a normal city that we have an old center heart, and then on the outside the city is growing more and more into the open space. So but that is very difficult to capture in some images for your book.
Yes, it sounds like you're proposing there'd be a 3D printer in the center of the floating city, creating new structures that would push out the other structures.
That's fantastic. That's not really the innovative city that that I would love. Yes. You're right. That's what it is. And you just print things that you need, and the old things are being pushed away. And if they are too far away, you can sell them to other cities. And by that, you have always a fresh new city. And also, if you think in terms of tourism, how fantastic is that you go to a city and the city is different than the one that you came 5 years before. Yes. But it's not in a system. If I go to Paris, I want to see the same Paris as 5 years ago. But if I go to Dubai and I'm like 8 to 10 times a year I have to fly to Dubai, and still every time when I'm in Dubai I see new things. That city is exactly what we should expect from a city that is growing and changing, because it's not a city that grows to the outside, but it grows also in the inside. And every time roads are different and buildings have been changed and already demolished, and it's very, very, really vibrant. And I think that it's not that I want to live in Dubai, but that feeling of a city that is constantly on the move and constantly adapting to new challenges, possibilities, that we can just bring together in a floating city with a 3D printer in the center and having all this kind of fantastic buildings and solutions popped out from the center.
And canals whereby people can say, you know, I want to move and go to a different city and found my own city. And you'd have this organically developing cities on the ocean with with flip-like structures keeping them stable in the waves. It's marvelous.
But if you think about that's freedom, and it's something that is almost your ideal seasteading city is Bangkok, as it was in 1850 or 1830, something like that. And 95% of the people were living on the water with all these floating houses, floating boats, floating elements. And it were only the army and the king who lived on land. And the rest of the community was just living on the water. And they were resilient to any flood. And then they could just move. And it was perfect. And then the city changed because people also moved their house from one location to another location if it was necessary. And they have totally changed from a complete dynamic, resilient city into a static, really threatened by flood city. Terrible. So the way people think that if you build a house on location, you own the plot on leave your location, and you can't move. Well, these kind of dogmas, these kind of very strong, almost concepts which have been implemented in our minds, we should start to cut them out and show people, architects and consumers and planners, that there is another kind of freedom, and that freedom also can bring us some very nice ways of living, and that could end up from moving your house from one part of the city to the other part of the city towards a complete floating community or country in the middle of the ocean. So having that as a timeline and a route to the future will be much more attractive to the audience than only telling them how a future of the city, a future country, and floating on the ocean can be without showing them steps in between. And that's what also discussed with Chris, is that we should much more, if we were together, show the roadmap map from here towards the next 100 years, but also showing them what's there in 2 years, what's there in 5 years, what's there in 10 years, and why all these steps are so necessary, and how in each step we solve a problem. And those problems are existing already now in the cities, and that with water we can make better cities. And that's coming back to green is good, blue is better.
And what's the best way to portray this roadmap, starting from step one and incremental steps?
Well, I think what you do is storytelling. I think having a good book, somebody who can really... Now, bring stories where people almost the start to believe that it is very close by, that it's not something that is to start only in 50 years, but that it can start tomorrow. And what happens if you have some floating buildings in New York, a floating sea tree in Europe? But what happens if we have whatever kind of floating buildings? And then slowly I tell them about what's going to happen with the Olympics and then. All these things we just talked about in the last half hour, these things are all just very simple concepts where people can understand why it's better to do that floating and then slowly grow to something that if you see all those steps, and also you understand that the end step where you have a complete floating community is not because we want to be there and we don't want any rules of a normal city. No, we do that because we think we can create a better, more... green, more sustainable, more friendly way of living on that location. And again, what you said just a half hour ago is that on that moment, people who live in that city say, oh, and how do you compete with floods and with earthquakes and with hurricanes on land? Because we are so much safer and so much better and so much more adaptive to everything here on the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, fluidly adaptive to everything. Like, it'd be unimaginable. You can't just move your neighborhood to a more economically better place or whatever people will do. I mean, that kind of fluid mobility will drive innovations we can't even imagine now.
Yeah.
And I know...
Joe, if you're this, the one thing is this. If we... I'm from 71, so I'm now 44. If you tell people in the 70s, like 30 years ago, about the internet and about how our world would change and how you just can communicate to everybody and just sending mails just by pushing two buttons, and that people wouldn't understand that. And that's the same what you are now doing to the world. You tell them how this floating city could be on the middle of the ocean and why it's so fantastic, but you don't tell all the steps in between. Also with the internet and with this complete, it has come in small steps, and every step is a step which is needed for the next step. And I think in your books you should describe it better than I tell it now, but in a way that people understand that it is a fantastic solution once they see all the steps in between that make sense towards that end solution.
And the steps that already exist.
Because technology is already there. It's only the reasoning why you should use that technology.
Yeah. And what you're talking about is even crazier. You're 44. I'm 49. So if you go back to 66, and people were talking about the rockets to the moon and space stations, and now we're talking about going to Mars, and yet when we talk about sea stations or floating cities, suddenly that seems futuristic and absurd. And building floating, economically restorative and environmentally restorative cities on the ocean is much more of an imperative than getting to Mars as far as solving existential problems. So I think we can shift the perspective, and I hope to continue to do this with the messaging. And I know Chris really enjoyed his talk with you and wants to continue the conversation about building 3D printed materials. And I hope you can continue talking with him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you've given me a lot of things to think about, opened my mind a lot of ways, and I spend all my time thinking about this. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely the same here. I enjoyed this talk. And now we probably will talk in a few weeks or a few months. I think this should be also a start of having more communication with seasteading. And I think the time is now there. And I think I'm ready to help you.
That I'm really gratified to hear that, because I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Okay. Well, have a nice day. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for what you do.
To find out more about seasteading, go to seasteading.org, check out our floating city project, and tell us what you want to see in your floating city. We're in various stages of negotiations with at least a half dozen potential host nations. Follow us, the Seasteading Institute, on Twitter and Facebook. Most people are surprised by how rapidly technologies are advancing to colonize the seas. My book, co-authored with Patry Friedman about seasteading, comes out in the summer of 2016 with Simon and Schuster. We survive on donations, and we are grateful for your contributions. I'd like to thank our hundreds of volunteers, especially Alexander Kosma, who helped me with this podcast.